Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, thanks again very much for coming. I think for a lot of us, our next guest would have achieved immortality had he written just the song Cheese and Onions. Or possibly, Equestrian Statue. Or the dizzying jazz of My Pink Half of the Drainpipe. Yeah. But he was the cornerstone and the main creative engine of both the Bonzos and the Ruttles. And as all right-thinking people agree, he was also the seventh member of Monty Python. Please welcome the fantastic Neil Innes. Yay! So, Neil, it's lovely to have you. Neil is wearing a sensational hat, which, it looks like you'd be worn by somebody who might live in France, which indeed you do.
No, actually, this came from America, New Mexico. I got it off a donkey.
Right. Excellent. Well, the traditional question normally is the music you grew up with. Now, you grew up in Germany, I think. Your father was in the military, is that right?
Yes,
you grew up
that's in Germany. Right. Gosh, research.
Yeah.
We moved there when I was about 5 or 6, and... It's always puzzled me about what the war was about, because I met really nice people who made fantastic cake,
yeah,
and they had wonderful model railways.
Yeah, what's not to like?
And there was skiing, but my father actually educated me in another way. He actually, when I was about 9 or 10. He showed us the films, from black and white newsreel footage, and it was a different story. But it was still hard to reconcile, the sunshine and the place outside and the friendly people with all this, the war. So, yeah. So I'm used to living abroad. I live abroad now. I live in France.
Yeah, you live in France. And what sort of music were you listening to before you came over to London?
Well, before I went to Germany, I'm told I used to sort of delay having my nappy put on as a toddler, dancing around with a bare bum, conducting the radio with a ruler. So I think I've always been keen on music.
Yes, that's
and I have fond memories of Joseph Locke saying, "Hear my song, Violetta," "in my gondola." That sort of thing. I grew up with that. And later on, I studied the piano when I was in Germany, and I got quite good at it. And I did, after 7 years, I wondered who I was working for, because they'd give me a piece of music by Chopin, Polonaise or something. I mean, reading all these sort of bunches of grapes and squashed flies. And as soon as I finished it, and played it to some degree of proficiency, they gave me a harder one. And when I was 14, I thought, who am I working for here? So I actually bought a guitar and became more interested in popular music. And we'd all heard Bill Haley and Rock Around the Clock and things like that.
So how old were you when those things came along?
About 12, right. I think, 12, 13, yeah. Yeah, listen to the Goon Show. I like what Duke Ellington said about music, and I'm with him on this. There's two kinds of music, good and bad, and it lights me up. Good music makes me feel good. And my new grandson, who's just one, we played him some real sort of down-home bass drum thumping hillbilly muck. But good muck. And and he was going like that to it. And I thought, hey, it's in the gene somewhere.
The Bonzos all came together when you were at art school. And were at Royal Holloway, and Viv was at Central or whatever. But how did you all meet? And also, what do you remember of first meeting the great Vivian? I mean, can you remember the moment you walked into the room?
Well, yeah. I was at Goldsmiths College in New Cross. And there was a big pub called the New Cross Inn, eponymously almost, This and I was to meet Viv. Rodney Slater brought him down, and I'd never met him before. And he and it's a big Irish pub, and he came in and he was wearing sort of Billy Bunter. He was quite porky in those days, and he had Billy Bunter trousers, a Victorian frock coat, and horrid pince-nez oval glasses perched on his nose, which he didn't need, and carried a euphonium under his arm.
As you do.
As you do.
Yeah.
And but the best thing of all, I mean, the most striking of all, after a while he said, good God. And he was wearing huge pink rubber false ears. And I thought, this is an interesting character. And you'd have thought somebody in the pub would have said, you know, but the Irish are very phlegmatic. You know, they must have taken one look and said, oh, we'll leave him alone. He's probably got enough problems of his own.
How did you all
so
finish
he wasn't
up?
On his way anywhere. You know, he just got to the pub.
No, he decided to create that ensemble to go to going south of the river.
Rushing
probably.
Back home thinking, I forgot to put on my rubber ears.
Yeah, I know. But, I mean, he instantly, he's the most likeable and roguish, you know, a chuckler. A Vulgarian, you
a
know.
Vulgarian.
He had a belch that could do four counties.
So how did you, a bunch of Arsenians, how did you all finish up in your correspondent shoes and your striped double-breasted suits?
Every Tuesday night, I think it was, we went... I lived in the same house as Vernon Dudley Beauhay-Noel. And he used to teach at the St. Martin's. And the house belonged to a chap called Val Dunnett, who also was a very talented watercolourist. He taught at St. Martin's as well. So we used to get in Vernon's Alvis, this ancient car that he'd built himself, which is virtually a tin bath on wheels, and go all the way to South Kensington from Blackheath every Tuesday night to sort of play with about 14 other people who bought very second-hand brass instruments and playing this kind of terrible Savoy Orphean English trad jazz. You know, it's tacky. But it's but songs like Let's All Go to Mary's House. You know, this is the stuff that the bright young things just after the war used to jitterbug and flap around to, you know. And so it tickled our fancy to find these things. And then a competition sort of grew where we'd go during the week to junk shops or street markets and find these boxes and boxes and boxes of old 78s. And in them, you know, we'd look through, you know, because we'd all had wind-up gramophones at home. But because you didn't know what you were buying. So this is tuppence and threepence each, you know, in old money. So you had to be careful.
You know? Oh, yeah.
And what usually gave it away was a thing on the label saying, Novelty Foxtrot. We're in. And then your eyes would sort of go down the label, not necessarily who'd done it, but the title. And when you see something like, I'm going to bring a watermelon to my girl tonight.
Well, we were going to mention
hello,
that.
Hello, I think this is going to be money well spent.
I don't know if anybody knows. I don't know if anybody knows the lyrics to this, but the first verse goes, if I remember right, it goes, I brought my girl an apple and she let me hold her hand. I bought my girl an orange and we kissed beneath the band. I bought my girl bananas and she let me squeeze her tight. I'm going to bring a watermelon to my girl tonight.
They knew how to have
they
fun.
They did it just so brilliant. But I love that sort of coy English humour. It's almost sort of P.G. Woodhouse sort of, you know, it's hilarious.
Well, the other things we found, like hunting tigers out in India.
Yeah.
And Alibaba's camel. The stalkers brought a son and daughter to Mr. and Mrs. Mickey Mouse.
That's right.
Oh, man, come on. The whole week was full of fun. You know, and what with finding these records and finding the worst ties. You could find, gosh, there were some stinkers out there.
Yeah.
You know, and so we'd sort of, it would be, you know, you'd turn up once a week and you'd say, I found this, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then, my God, where did you get that one from? You know, the tie. And so, yeah.
But I love the idea that this was going on while it was the Beatles, and it was the Stones, it was the Kinks, it was Petula Clark, it was pop music explosion. And you're going off and playing these 78s. And this, the only people who were doing it, I think, were the Temperance Seven. Were they pretty much the only group playing that kind of music.
Yeah, well, the Temperance Seven did it beautifully, I thought. I mean, I think they were top of the pops when I was still at school.
So there was a precedent.
Yeah, songs like Pasadena, wasn't it?
But when I was at art school, I'm more keen on the Alberts. The Alberts and Professor Bruce Lacey. They had a show in Shepherd's Bush called An Evening of British Rubbish.
Yeah.
And that sort of tied in with the Bonzos look. You know, I must say that, you know, what you have to realise is that these records are all made around the time of the Great Depression. You know, I mean, I know we have our ups and downs these days, but it's like bipolar compared to what went on then. But to have these funny records coming out, and I think that just in our young, innocent days of being 20-somethings, you know, we just thought it's time for a change. I think we were aware of our parents' generation having been through a world war. And my mother, you know, sort of thought she was the bee's knees because she could tie a headscarf like the Queen and just about like every other woman of her age.
That's right.
And you say, oh, come on, it's cheer up time, you know. And so we rubbished the Empire and everything else and pith helmets, largely influenced by the Alberts. And anyway, the fact is that Vernon and I got a bit sick of this bone-shaking journey all the way from Blackheath to South Ken. We found a pub in Forest Hill near Dulwich called the Bird in Hand. And we went in there. It was like the Marie Celeste, this vast Victorian pub with a big empty back room. And we said, do you mind if our band comes and plays in here? Because half the distance, they'd have to, you know, meet us halfway. He said, he's got his fag out of his mouth. He's polishing his glass. I said, well, I don't mind. You know, she might as well. So we said, all right. So we set it up. And the band duly arrived and set up in the corner. It had a fairly good piano, and we just started playing. We didn't know what would happen, but after about an hour, it was half full. About an hour and a half, it was heaving. Whatever we did, it was fantastic drinking music.
Yeah.
And we said to the landlord, "It's all right if we pass the hat round." He said, "Yes, of course you can." And he gave us 25 quid. He said, "Come back next week." It was like being on telly, you know.
so that's when, about 1966 or something like that?
Oh, I can't do dates.
But it's interesting because there's a sort of understood tradition for music and comedy. You've got groups like They Might Be Giants, or you've got the Half Man, Half Biscuit or whatever. But back then there was Peter Sellers, and there was the Baron Knights, and who else? Bernard Cribbins.
The pubs were really, even though the Beatles were happening, the Stones were trickling through.
Yeah.
You had Chris Barber, had Humphrey Littleton, you had Kenny Ball, you know, and the unspeakable stranger on the shore.
But precisely the moment that trad jazz was being booted out by the Beatles, you were bringing jazz back, which I love.
Yeah, but irreverently,
ironically.
Remember, we weren't the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band initially. We were the Bonzo Dog Dada Band, you know, being pretentious art school. You know. Dada was not a turn-of-the-century anti-art movement, but it was founded in 1916 in the middle of the World War One, and a very good thing that he said, isn't it about time we questioned what was going on, you know? And I think in 2016, I thought, 100th anniversary of Dada, isn't it about time we questioned some of the things that are going on again? But that was the thing. It was a term of a mixture of anything, but I don't know. We could get trapped in that decade, but how it moved on from that. I mean, you can see we all loved doing it, and we took ourselves very seriously. We're looking at a photograph here, listener.
Yeah, we are.
Of the Bonzos, and I think there's about 9 of us there. Yes. And so we ended up with, from 14, we turned up into that 9, and we played about 5 pubs a week. And it was wonderful because, I mean, art students are A, strangers to work, and B, you know, don't know, I'm not very good at money, because paint costs money, and so does beer, you know. So it was great to make some pocket money.
Had you developed the holding up the speech bubbles and the thought bubbles at the stage? That was part of it, wasn't
all
it?
All part of it.
Because I can vividly remember this, that the new vaudeville band came along and completely stole your entire act. And then people were coming up to you thinking that you had stolen your act off the new vaudeville band. So that forced you away from that kind of comedy into music into the rock sphere, wasn't
there
it?
There we are.
We're looking
cue.
At the new picture of the new vaudeville
band.
We're
looking at the...
The felons themselves.
No. Well, are they a new vaudeville band?
I think so.
Oh, I see what you mean, because I saw Bob Kerr there. Bob Kerr was our trumpeter at the time we started doing cabaret clubs up north. And we had all the suits and, you know, and he knew Jeff Stevens very well. And Jeff Stevens wrote Winchester Cathedral and put the new vaudeville band together, which was basically session men. And he suddenly had a hit on his hands. And no one
Winchester Cathedral, wasn't it?
Winchester Cathedral. Yeah.
Number one record.
Yeah. Yes, and no one to promote it. So he rings up Bob and said, Bob, I hear you playing with this silly band. How would you like to be the new vaudeville band? And Bob comes rushing into the digs where everybody said, we can be the new vaudeville band. We can be on top of the pops. And the rest of us went, why? And he said, well, I'm going to do it. And we said, well, off you go then. Good luck. Never darken our towels again. You know? But, you know, the bit was, you know, the next thing on television, on top of the pops, there they are with the same suits, shoes, bad ties, speaking balloons.
Your entire
singer
act.
And alarm. No, yeah, and of course people said, hey, you're like that new vaudeville band. You know.
There's
so that's when
moment.
We realised we were in show business.
Absolutely. Now, I read an interview with you once when you talked about, at this time, being in Abbey Road watching the Beatles recording. Was that
that was a bit
playing...
later when... yeah,
I want to tell you, I think it was.
No. We were still in that mould doing those silly old things.
Yeah.
My brother makes the noises for the talkies.
Yeah.
And that's when I went on... they're all doing sound effects, you know, making them up like... However you do, there's no CDs full of 1001 sound effects.
Yeah.
So I took a break and I went down to the restrooms. And as I came back, in Abbey Road, there's some steps. And you came back up the steps and my head was floor level, just as, you know, four guys with distinctive haircuts and tight trousers and dark glasses and two big miners. Minders?
Miners.
Yeah. We'll leave the paedophile bit out.
Yeah.
And then, so they came in through the door, dramatically lit by the sunlight from Abbey Road. And I thought, well, them? Of course, they record here too, don't they? But, I mean, I was intrigued. And I did sneak out and listen to what they were doing outside the thing. And they were doing I Want to Tell You, George's thing.
With that wonderful discordant piano part. And you kind of...
The F over the E. And years later, I was talking to George about it in the kitchen, his kitchen. And he said, oh, yeah, the F over the E, yeah. And he just, outside the kitchen, there's a piano there, and I started playing. And he picked up a guitar, and he went, do-do-do-do, which is not the easiest riff.
No.
But he hadn't played it in years, and he immediately played it.
Yeah.
So we just blunked away, you know. But
you thought that's kind of the future. We've got to get away from this.
I was in love. Yeah. I thought this is the way music should go. It's exciting, you know. And I am a Beatle fan. You know, I'm not a fan of the Sgt. Pepper suits, but the basic music and everything else. I think Penny Lane was one of the most wonderful things.
Fantastic.
You know, full of images. You know, just wonderful. I thought popular music should be like this. You know.
It's like a movie, isn't it?
Yeah.
Each verse telling
Bonzo's
a story.
Bonzo's had you had your time with United Artists, Liberty Records, whatever. You're on the rock circuit and so forth. How do you regard that when you look back on it now? And those records, are you really proud of them?
I think yes, yeah, in a way, in a daft way, not in a smug, self-satisfied way, but by accident. Well, they're not too bad considering, because after the new vaudeville band thing, I think it was Legs Larry Smith who said, we should play any kind of music we want and do whatever we want with anything, you know. And we all agreed, and we thought, well, we all had stupid suits made of whatever we wanted and just blew it all. And Bob did us a big favour, because we wouldn't have started writing our own songs. the world would never have heard Can Blue Men Sing the White?
Exactly, exactly.
So I take the word pride lightly, you know. But no, we shared the same sort of sense of humour. And also at the same time, you know, we were sharing the same images. You know, going around the country, seeing different cities, but with the same embryonic one-way systems and the same stuff in the same shops. There was an awareness of suddenly everything was getting homogenized and people farming was just beginning, you know. And so we adopted the kind of approach of we are normal and we want our freedom and all that kind of thing. We felt it was up to us to sort of make a bit of a row about it, but have a bit of fun.
With songs like the intro and the outro and My Pink Half of the Drainpipe and Mr. Apollo and stuff, they all seem to be having a go at the kind of self-important and the celebrities and the famous and the egomaniacal, you know. And I felt it was a kind of satire. Did you think of yourselves as satirists?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
But what we failed to realise at the time, we were being just as egotistical and self-important as anybody else. Yeah. Yeah. We were sort of like saying, oh, you said we are normal, you know. Oh, look, here come some normals. You know, I mean, that's outrageous, really. But it was innocent fun. It was a kind of collective observationism that we were doing. You know, we lived very closely in the band, in the van, you know, and often there'd be periods of silence and someone would say, screaming fit? Yeah, screaming fit. Okay, screaming fit. We go, ah!
You know, wonderful.
And we had, again, Vivian was one of these larger-than-life characters. We became very keen on the hottest curries we could find. And once we were going through Leeds and said, look, look! And there was a restaurant called the Khyber Pass Restaurant. And, of course, we had to eat there. But once we came out of a restaurant at lunchtime and walking around, I said, where's Viv? And he was back down the pavement, and a little old lady with one of those wicker shopping baskets with wheels, you know, he'd sort of drop down on one knee and started singing, one alone to be my own, I alone to know her caresses, one to be eternally the one my worshipping soul possesses. Anyway, all right to the end, he goes, anyone else would have been swiped round the head with the handbag.
Yeah, but he got away.
Yeah, at the end she said, utter oh, child. That's very nice, love. Thank you very much. Not at all, my dear. You're most welcome.
Well, he's so charming. It was a brilliant song, which I'm sure people here will remember, Shirt. And in the middle of Shirt, the recording, he went out with a microphone on a kind of 100-foot cable and just interviewed people in the street about shirts.
Right. That was Roger Spears' song, Shirt.
Yeah.
But we put all the microphone leads we could together, Morgan Studios in Willesden, and made them reach Willesden High Street. You may ask why, but only after this. But to sort of to liven things up, he went out with this kind of rabbit's head helmet.
That's right.
And in his underpants.
Yeah.
And I can hear somebody saying, well, look at him. He's got a head on him like a rabbit. That's not normal, is it?
You know? That's right, yes. Which you don't understand as a listener, you know.
And then talking about shirts, you know, said, we're talking about shirts, you know, said, he said, do you like the short shirt or the long shirt? Well, you've got to be fashionable these days.
Yeah, you're certainly with it. That's right.
That's right. Nobody was doing that much.
No.
Now, every blinking news around programme does vox pops, as they're called. But they were very fresh, and, you know, you never knew what you were going to get, and it was just fun stringing it all together.
Do you think that one of the reasons it lives on so well is because it was funny? So people just repeat it to each other. There'll be somebody tonight saying J. Arthur Rankin Gong.
Yes. Or
they will.
They just will be. You know,
yes,
some people in a pub will be saying, you have the same trouble with your trousers as I do. You know?
Yes.
I still send text messages to a mate, and every time we're always Quasimodo on Belt or Adolf Hitler on Vibe. We think it's hilarious.
Looking very relaxed.
Looking very relaxed, exactly. I know,
but that was recorded in Regent Sound, which was in Denmark Street, on 4-track. 1-inch four track. Right. Or would it half inch? No, good. Very thin tape, and we had to sort of keep one track free to mix the other two down, and so on and on and on. This went on forever, you know, because look how many overdubs there are in that thing. But it was a great thing to have done, because it probably, if you sort of sat about it and thought about it and said, oh, why bother, you know. But we didn't, and we made it, you know, and it was a bit of inspiration, you know.
And you became incredibly fashionable, didn't you? I mean, all the kind of rock fraternity.
Well, they were so all jealous.
You were actually, they, even played the Isle of Wight Festival, was that right?
Yes.
Who were you on before and after, can you remember?
I can't remember, but I know that Legs Larry Smith had disappeared with Keith Moon somewhere, and we hadn't got a drummer.
You had no drummer, that's right.
No.
Wasn't Jimi Hendrix on that?
No, I don't think he was, not that one. No, but
who played drums in his absence?
Well, Jim Capaldi.
Jim Capaldi, that's right. Of Traffic, yeah.
And Dennis Cowan, the bass player, you know, we're used to Larry, who was an art student and stranger to work, and he used to get tired of drumming and just stand up and blow kisses to people. So we'd have to keep it going, you know. Yeah. And now we were with Jim Capaldi, a real drummer. You know, we were having a time of our lives, you know. And all of a sudden, Larry suddenly appeared. And we were, oh, no.
So it was all going so well.
It was. Yeah. It was. And so he picked up a tambourine, he faffed around and blew some kisses, you know. And we get to Canyons of Your Mind, and he goes over to Jim and said, this one's a bit tricky, Jim. I think I better take it. Yeah.
The group kind of ultimately split up because you were trying to crack America, weren't you? I mean, you were supporting the Who and the Kinks and people like that. I mean, and I think it all became too much for Viv, didn't it? He started to unravel slightly.
He unraveled a bit, but he certainly wanted to go.
Yeah.
That was the thing about the Bonzos. 5 years we were on the road and fated and doing all this thing. But we never had a holiday, and we bought off three managers. I know it's expensive, you know, and so we had to keep doing things, and then it was, and Tony Stratton Smith, Charisma Records and all sorts of, he said, well, you just go, you know, and unfortunately, I think he picked 1969. That was the year that just about every British band went to America, and managers were sort of, you know, barefist fighting, you know, for the gigs that were there, and but we went, and Viv did unravel, but before then he'd sort of signalled his enthusiasm for going by sort of saying, I hear, you know, the audience is wonderful out there, and, you know, they want to touch the hem of your robe. So, but yeah, so I've forgotten why we talked about America. But
well, we should go back in time very slightly, because talk about you joining Do Not Adjust Your Set with the three members of Monty Python and Denise Coffey and David Jason, I think.
Yeah,
how did the Bonzos get involved in that? You did about 26 shows, I think.
Yeah, we did.
More,
the incredibly youthful Humphrey Barclay, I think he was about 12 at the time, he left Cambridge, got given the job of coming up with the children's television programme. And so he immediately did the Oxbridge connection, got Mike and Terry from Oxford and Eric from Cambridge, found Denise Coffey and an up-and-coming character actor called David Jason,
yeah,
who we adored, actually. He just split our, you know, we. So the first 13 episodes were done with the Bonzos, and this, you know, and it was just fun and vibrant. There was a chemistry right from the off. You know, there was a certain amount of circling of suspicion between the Oxbridge lot and us. You know, we were art school and they were, you know, sort of more, you know, compare and contrast kind of writers. And they liked Chinese food and we liked Indian food. So we'd take them out to Indian food and they'd take us out to Chinese food. But it was all, you know, jolly. But we had to do, you know, something out different every week, but we were working all week.
We were gigging all week.
And then, oh, God, it's terrible. And once we were in our digs and the phone went, and I picked it up and they said, Rediffusion, the television company, want to know what props you need for next week's show. Oh, no, they got Larry. That's right, they got Larry. I'm telling the story wrong. Larry answered the phone and said, what props do you need? And he said, oh, three cardboard boxes, a springboard, and a petrol tanker.
And when you got there...
But 2 days later, who picks up the phone but Muggins? We've got the cardboard boxes and the springboard, but we're having trouble with the petrol tanker. Would an oil drum do? And I had the luckless task of telling them, well, Larry was kidding you. Yeah. You know, and this went on, you know. And often we'd make up, we'd dress as footballers or something. We'd do, in the last minute, we'd think of something by the time we got there. And never did anything the same twice. So it was...
Was it live?
Yeah, no, as live, right. Yeah. But there was telecine, I think. No, yeah. I think it was live. Yeah, because that's why...
Children's programming.
Yeah.
With the Bonzo dog band.
Yeah.
Eric Idle, whatever.
Eric
live.
Well, I remember seeing you on Blue Peter.
And now a completely naked man. And Eric sat in the chair going, hello.
I can remember seeing you on Blue Peter doing Bill Bailey, I think. I mean, amazing.
Oh, yeah, we did Blue Peter. We did all sorts of things, but it was the 60s, it was the late 60s, it was a blur.
Yeah.
People did whatever they did. And
But Python said that they were very influenced by...
It was an anarchy of the Bonzos. They suddenly thought, we don't need a punchline. We could just... And then by the second series, Terry Gilliam had joined with his fabulous animations. And it was great. It was another ally. He was another art student.
Yeah.
And that morphed into Monty Python. And now for something completely different. And it's largely from the influence of, these irresponsible, not them. This is radio, isn't it? Yeah. We're looking at sort of knights from the Holy Grail.
We're looking at the Holy Grail, a picture on the far right there.
It was. It was the way it morphed. It certainly made Python seem possible because, Mike and Terry and Eric had worked, and Terry Gilliam, the two Terrys, Mike thing, had experience of that. And I think Cleese was writing with Chapman around the same time, and on a Thursday night they used to stop and get home early so they could watch Do Not Adjust Your Set.
So, and they rang you up and asked you to be the warm-up man for the...
When they became Python, Eric rang me up and said, do you fancy coming up to Shepherd's Bush? I said, why? He said, I'm warm-up man, Zill. I said, I don't do warm-ups. He said, it's £25. I said, all right, done.
I said, when's it start?
And you toured with them and
you wrote
music for Matching Tie and Handkerchief and you were really involved.
Yeah. And all the live concerts. And it worked really well because, I could do my little bits while they were rushing off and getting changed and things. How lucky can you get? Being part of the Bonzos and then being part of the Python situation.
Fantastic.
There's no way you could sort of put that on a sort of mission statement, CV, ambition.
When do you see yourself in 10 years' time?
Yeah. In Holy Grail, you were crushed by a giant wooden rabbit or something.
Well, this is it. Both Terry Gilliam and I, get it from the words people. They don't really understand pictures or music or anything. Their insecurity comes out, so that every time anything heavy is lobbed out of a castle, it lands on me.
I'll just talk about a little bit about is this your first solo album? How sweet to be an idiot.
Yes, that's right.
And those were the days when you could, pose on the cover of your album with a duck hat on while holding a kind of prosthetic penis, I think it's fair to say.
Well... You read that into it.
Oh, okay. It's just my diary.
Occurred to me. I was just like, I think there's all sorts of things. They could probably one like that, but it was just the clown thing. I've always liked clowns. And have you ever seen Slava, the Russian clown? Have you ever seen his snow show? It's fantastic because not only does it make you laugh, it actually makes you weep. Have we got time? The opening of Snow Show, Slava comes out in like a boiler suit and he's got a rope around his neck. And everyone goes, huh? And he goes into the centre of the stage and you don't realise he's been crouching in the boiler suit because he suddenly goes up a foot when he lifts it. And people go, huh? Like that, and he suddenly notices there might be people or something. And then he does this just the right amount of time. Then the audience really get more courageous. They say, no, no, no. And they say, okay, so he starts pulling the rope, and he pulls this rope, and there's about 40 feet of it, you know, and he goes on and on pulling the rope. And then at the end of it is a little clown with the rope around his neck. And I love that sort of thing. So I was big on clowns in those days, and that's really how sweet to be an idiot and wearing a kind of duck on my head.
So one track on this record proved to have a strange afterlife.
Which one?
The one that we need the story of the legal case with Oasis, because How Sweet to Be an Idiot.
Oh, that, of course.
The track Whatever by Oasis, yes. By Noel Gallagher, clearly lifts the entire melody from How Sweet to Be an Idiot. Well, and there was a court case.
No, there wasn't. There wasn't a court case. The papers left to say there was. They said there was a court case over the Ruttles. There wasn't. It's just... But Mike McCartney, Paul's brother, rang me up and said, have you heard Oasis's new record? No. He said, well, it's very similar to How Sweet to Be an Idiot, which he knew because we used to do it on Grimm's. And he said, Nicky Campbell has just played it back-to-back on Radio 1, so there's already this thing going.
Yeah.
You know, and eventually I did hear it, and I thought, well, the opening line's the same, but I don't know. And so I thought, well, I'll ring up United Artists. I thought, EMI, I think it was, publishing. I said, but what about this? Oh, we're on it. You know, what do you mean you're on it? He said, well, we've got it, we're settled. You know, they settled for 25% or something. Oh, well, all right, then, well, you don't need...
That's great, so you get a credit.
Yeah, exactly.
You're credited all the way.
No, and Spool On, Noel put out a box set or something, and he wanted to put Whatever on it, and they rang up and said, look, this is a pain, you know, to have to sort of go through the publishing for this freebie single or something. I said, no, go on, do ahead, you know. So anyway, Noel sent me a lovely box set with, you know, autographed Neil. So it's people in the business are much nicer than the businessmen in the people, you know.
Yeah, that was certainly racked up to be a bit of a court case. But
well, of course it was.
Amicably settled.
Well, never underestimate the enemy, you know, because they had a headline, Neil and Mr. Sue Oasis, you know, for whatever. And if you read on, if you bothered, it says, Neil insists to sue Oasis over the use of the whatever, How Sweet to Be an Idiot. Or at least we assume he is, because we phoned up and he wasn't in.
So, that's right. So he must have been in court.
He must have been seeing his lawyers, you know.
Some rigorous news hounds of the NME.
Exactly. Never allow a fact
robust
to interfere.
A good
story.
Yeah. So the Ruttle stories started with the Ruttle Weekend Television, and there were a couple of sketches, I think, short sketches with the Ruttles band.
Yeah.
So how did that translate into becoming All You Need Is Cash?
Well, very.
I do love these titles. I'd forgotten. Yeah,
I know.
About, I am the waitress.
Eric is a master. I am the waitress.
All You Need is Cash. And what was the other one? I Can't Buy Me Lunch.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's just that was the second. I've forgotten.
But no, Eric is a master of those things. Yeah, I am the waitress. Your mother should go.
Your mother should go.
And WC Fields Forever.
Superb.
But no, it did start. You know, Eric asked me when we were doing Drury Lane, so if I fancied doing television with him. And I said, I don't like television. Camera's not pointing anyway. So you can tell the cameras where to point. Oh, I said, that's different. And so he explained Rutland Weekend Television. Smallest county, smallest budgets, you know, a license to make cheap-looking television, and that's probably the only reason BBC Two commissioned it. So my job was to come up with musical ideas with the images to go with it, and he would work on some skits. And we'd meet up every now and again and say, what have you got? What have you got? And we'd write them on postcards and put them on the notice board and see where the shows were. And I said, well, I think we could do a spoof of A Hard Day's Night. You know, it's black and white, speed it up, four guys in tight trousers and wigs running around a field. Cheap.
Yeah.
And he said, that's good, that's good. I've got this sketch about a documentary maker who's so dull the camera runs away from him.
That's it. Yeah. Brilliant.
6 or 7 minutes, sorted.
And it happens in the film, and he runs after the van, doesn't he? Trying to keep up with the camera.
Yeah, yeah. So, but the camera says, I've had enough of this, you know. No, is it? So, at the same time, Phil Bernstein, or somebody who put the promoter of the Beatles in America, trying to get them together again.
Sid Bernstein.
Sid. I'm talking about Phil Silvers, that's what I'm thinking of.
Phil Silvers.
Yeah, that would have been good. Brilliant.
But anyway, he is offering them $20 million each and a killer whale as a pet. You know, if they'll get back together. No, the world was heartbroken. The Beatles had split up. What on earth? You know, it's like the moon is colliding with the, you know. So, Saturday Night Live, this NBC spoof satire program, started doing a running gag on it, and they got George Harrison on, and Lorne Michaels, the producer, had $3,000 in cash and waved it under George's nose, saying, well, this can be yours, George, just get the guys back together again, you know. And George, doing his best acting, said, what, all of this for me? And they said, no, you have to share it with the others. Maybe you don't have to tell Ringo. You know, these jokes were out there, you know. And so, to spur it on, they said, we got Eric Idle to host the show, because they always had a host, because he said he could get the Beatles back together for $300. So, you know, and then it come to the moment, and said, Lorne comes on again. Well, you have to apologise, because, you know, as you know, Eric said he could get the Beatles together for $300, but we realise now it's a bad phone line and he hasn't got the Beatles, he's got the Ruttles. And they showed the clip from Rotten Weekend Television and the running away thing. And people were ready for it. After Nixon, whatever, the collapse of the Beatles, they were writing in with Beatles crossed out and Ruttles written in. So Norm Marks just had to go downstairs and get the budget for All You Need Is Cash. And it's 40 years ago this year that it was broadcast on prime time in America, and I'm most proud that to this day it's the lowest rated program on prime time ever, you know. And who remembers the episode of Charlie's Angels, you know?
Absolutely.
People were suddenly going, what is this? You know, yeah. too stoned or something to sort of change channels. You know.
I watched it again the other night. You must have had such fun making that music.
Total fun.
It's fantastic, Phil.
Yeah.
I watch it once a year.
I can't resist it. Well, this is why we tour it. You know, every now and again you get the pang. You have to go out and play them again. They are a lot of fun.
How did you write those songs? Because you listen to songs like, Hold My Hand. I Must Be in Love, and it sounds like you can specifically recognise echoes of three or four different
Beatles songs. A lot of people think I sat down and listened to the Beatles songs. I didn't. I knew I'd be sunk. You see, going back to thinking, all of a sudden they're going to do the whole story. Let's do the whole story, you know, in the barn, you know, with Mickey and what's that? Well, who's the... That's it. Thank you. Judy Garland, speak up.
Thank you.
And it was that kind of moment. And I thought, any minute now, you know, and sure enough, and I was sitting in a cool way on the windowsill across the office, and they suddenly realised, they're going to need songs. And they looked at me and they said, Neil, do you reckon you could write 20 more Ruttle songs by next Thursday lunchtime? And I said, oh, well, I'll try. You know, and instinctively I knew if I listen to any Beatles songs, I'm sunk. So I came from the approach of, where was I when that song was doing? And I tried to recapture the environment. And the hardest songs, you know, you have to remember, I was lucky enough to go to co-educational school. So girls were not a mystery, you know, in our school. So the hardest songs were like Hold My Hand and I Must Be in Love and things like that. The other ones, like Pineapple Pine in the Sky and, you know, Swastika Nightingales crooning tongue in cheek, were a lot easier.
The psychedelic
thing you could just have a lot more fun with. But they were signposts, you know, you needed like Love Life, you needed I Am the Waitress, you know.
Yeah.
So, and the other rule I made was if I made the song on a piano or just a guitar and it still works as a song, I know it's a song.
Yeah.
Then you listen to the production and you learn from the master, you know, George Martin, and the Beatles' own creativity. And so, yeah, I managed to write the songs in about 3 months. And another good idea I had, is you can count them on half a hand, was to get the band rehearsing in this place in North London with a chap called Alistair with 2 Revox machines, and we recorded. And we came out after 2 weeks, taking a break to watch Wimbledon, as a band. We played and we went into the studio, and the whole album, from beginning to end, overdubs, mixing, was 10 days.
Incredible.
The second one took even longer.
Yeah. But what did the Beatles think of it as managers? I mean, we can tell George Harrison was obviously enormously enthused because he was in the movie, but I mean, what John Lennon, I think, liked it, didn't he?
He did like it. He did.
But Paul McCartney wasn't quite so sure.
I don't think, actually, and the more I think about it, the less I think he liked it. He's always been very nice to me, but I think he hated Eric's portrayal of him.
Yeah.
Or, you know. But he's always been very more than generous to me. But I think, really, you know, he does, you know, he takes the view that, you know, you couldn't have done it without us, which I don't think is quite fair, because a lot of the Beatle music they couldn't have done if it hadn't been for other styles of music.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's like, you know, back to Duke Ellington again, good and bad. You borrow, you take what's good. You know, and
but also so clearly affectionate. I mean, there's no reason to take offense,
exactly, you know? Exactly. So, I mean,
George became a good friend of yours, didn't he?
Yes, yes, absolutely. My wife Yvonne is a very, very good garden designer. She's got more than 12 medals from Chelsea Flower Show, and. Oh, she might have got some medals from the Chelsea. Yeah. But George has this fantastic place in Henley with 40 acres of garden. It was laid out by an eccentric called Sir Frank Crisp. And there's a Japanese garden, a topiary garden. There's a rockery that's the size of a small house. It was a scale model of the Matterhorn.
Fantastic.
You know, and George has brought it all back to life. And, you know, and only George would do it because he had the money to do it, and so Yvonne has helped a lot in the, you know, in the garden and the kitchen garden and things like that. It's an immensely difficult problem to garden on that scale.
Yeah.
Do you put 300 maples in, or you know, how many bedding plants or whatever?
Yeah.
So, you know, we over the years we sort of, you know.
Well, those of us who were lucky to be at the concert for George, the memorial concert, remember you in the... And we're looking at a picture of it now, actually, and that's you on the, I think, the far left as a Mountie. Tom Hanks on the far right next to Eric.
Yes, no, Tom Hanks. No, I'm actually playing the piano.
Oh, you play the piano?
Yeah.
Sorry, I've accused you of being somebody else.
No. there's a photograph up there with... Yeah, that's when I directed one of George's videos. long story short, you know, but... it was for Blow Away, and Jonathan Clyde, who's working with George, said, you know, can you come up with a script? There's not a lot of money. And I came up with a script, and George says, well, buy him a camera. You know, so that was his way of saying yes. So we did that video of Blow Away. But Tom Hanks was the sort of celebrity in that one. But when we did the City Centre, there were all kinds of people. George was a Mountie one night. And but most memorably, Harry Nilsson. He was the only Mountie with his buttons done up wrong. And when he took a bow at the end, he couldn't stop and went straight into the orchestra pit.
No drink was
That's
taken.
Harry
no,
Nilsson.
It is. I know, but he was completely unhurt. No Harry Nilsson was hurt in the no, making of this song. No, no.
Just very briefly, the Idiot Bastard Band, your latest incarnation with Ade Edmondson, Phil Jupitus, and Roland Riveron.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what sort of stuff do you play?
Well, anything we like. the idea was to do it in a pub, which we did. And we'd only did one tour, but Ade is very, you know, musical. I mean, he's also done the Bad Shepherds and things like that, which is really good. And yeah,
punk
we wanted to
played on ukulele, isn't it?
We wanted to revive the comedy song a bit. And so we did that. And people like Paul Whitehouse came down. And he's got a tremendous voice. He can sing like Tom Jones. Really? I mean, it's not effortless, you know. And the thing, There Might Be Giants who did the thing about the sun.
Birdhouse in Your Soul.
No, Birdhouse in Your Soul. The what?
The sun is a massive...
Yeah, is that Might Be Giants?
Yeah.
And so... Paul is doing this, you know, and I'm playing the piano next to him, you know, and I suddenly realise he's doing the most impeccable impression of Brian Cox. Well, I start wetting myself, you know, and I nearly put him off. I said, "It's Brian Cox," you know. But we had a lot of fun those nights in the pub. It was really good.
So now you're about to go on tour.
Yep.
Again.
Yep.
With the Ruttles. How's that going to work?
Well, I'm raring to lie down. it's going to be fine. We're going to put in some new songs we haven't done before, like Knicker Elastic King. the thing is, by chance, you know, I've never had an ambitious bone in my body, but... one thing led to another. Anyway, it occurred to me it would be fun to do a Ruttle album. It wasn't quite a proper Ruttle album, but a bits and pieces thing. And so I thought, well, why not call it the Wheat Album? It is all white, actually, and it has got a corn dolly on the back. But it's the Wheat Album is an album for Ruttle fans with ears.
It works. It works.
Because, I know.
I
know.
What he's done.
Well, what about Your Mother Should Go? Come on. the thing is, there's a song some people would have heard called Imitation Song, which has crept out, but not really properly. So that kind of kicks it off. But the rest are the demos from the album Archaeology, which are... they were looked after by someone else, not me. I can't look after it. And I thought, they've actually got a life of their own. There's a wonderful version of Ina Klein, A Middle Class of Music. And Knicker Elastic King. Yeah. And these songs have come of age. And I thought, well, to sort of nod towards the White Album a bit, I had this thing I did a while ago called Them. And it was basically a poem about evolution. 3 minutes, you know, they came faceless on jelly limbs crawling out of the living sea, and it was this kind of very BBC East Lynn voice, and I thought, well, I can call it Evolution Number 10. So,
oh, brilliant. Superb.
And I had a muck about with it, and then sort of I've got number 10. And I put a few humpback whales on there, and actually I think it's really quite nice.
That's brilliant.
And so there's that on there, and a wonderful version of Shangri-La, which is different, and a thing that Rory Bremner rang up one day and said, this week the Beatles have put out Free as a Bird and Lady Di has gone on Panorama. I said, I can do Lady Di. Can you do the Beatles? I said, again, I don't know. I'll have a thing. But it came together. I mean, I wrote this song called Don't Know Why. And it's like based on Free of the Bird, but, you know, with the same kind of feel. So that's it. And I like it because I think over the 20 years, these songs have come of age and they actually remind you of the sort of funny world we live in now. And I think they're kind of humorous, but they've got a clown-esque thing yeah. about
they
them.
They do.
They're yeah. a little bit sad, but they're a little bit funny as well.
So you're playing, what, 20 dates?
Yeah, at least.
So
yeah.
you'd be coming to a town near everybody.
Pretty much, yes. Don't ask me to remember. I know we're doing London on the 9th, in the garage, and the Comedia in Brighton on the day after. I think I already know the first few. Right. We go to Aberdeen, we go to Glasgow. We nearly went to Stornoway, but it was a bridge too far. but we're going to probably do a tour of the Highlands. Just to get up there and do it, and probably go to Ireland as well, Era, before they can put a border in.
Well, look, I'm sure everybody's looking forward to that.
We are, you know. But we're calling it the Major Happy Tour, because those of you who don't know, the second album, Archaeology, there's a song called Major Happy. Major Happy's up and coming Once Upon a Good Time band. And this is the Major Happy Tour. And for some venues, we're actually introducing a Major Happy Hour. No, we're having fun.
Brilliant.
Neil, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, a joy. Thank you very much for having me.
It's lovely to have you here this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, Neil Innes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Thank you very much.